And so we come to the sixth of the lectures, in which I understand he'll be looking at the history of consequences in literature. And so a very warm welcome to all of you to this lecture, especially to those of you who are joining us from outside Dunedin. Very sorry that the live streaming didn't work yesterday, but hopefully it's working today. If you have any questions during the lecture, please text 021 558 141, and we'll do our best to field those questions at the end. But in the meantime, please join me in welcoming, for the sixth time, Professor Chun Leong Siao to our lecture.
Thank you again for coming, and thank you once again for the honor of this invitation. It's been a lot of fun for me to put together my ideas and to share them with you. Thank you. Beauty begets beauty. Because the Book of Job is such a beautiful literary work, there's always been literary reception of Job, starting in the 4th century BCE with the Jewish book of Tobit. Tobit, whose name in Hebrew was Tobiah. God is good. So it's a theodic retelling of the book in the Jewish context. There, very clearly, Job's a Jew. But there are just hundreds, thousands even, of works of literature from antiquity to the present. And starting in the 17th century, you have works in various languages around the world. So what today's, in order to give us some boundaries, I'm going to focus today on Western modern literature. And only a sample of them. They said it's just way too much to cover, but just a sample of modern literature. But I should perhaps begin with when's modernity? When does modern literature begin, and how did it come about? Well, we have the usual culprits: Renaissance and humanism, rationalism, of course. But one I think is important for literature of Job and the Bible is Christian Hebraism. Christians could not read Hebrew prior to the 16th century. There were very, very few exceptions. Jerome was one, though Jerome's Hebrew was really quite limited. In the 14th century, there was a Franciscan scholar named Nicholas of Lyra, who was really the first Christian who could read Hebrew well enough to engage the text fully. Jerome depended on teachers, but Nicholas was able to read Hebrew well enough to read the Bible and rabbinical works. But after that, really, everybody depended on Nicholas of Lyra. Then in 1506, with great difficulty, Johannes Reuchlin, who always wanted to study Hebrew, finally managed to learn Hebrew from a 20-year-old rabbi in Italy. And he wrote the first Hebrew grammar in 1506. It's really the first grammar accessible to Christians, 1506. And that made the Reformation possible. Luther had a copy of it in 1509. And Luther kept working on it. It took him some 20 years before he was able to read Hebrew with some fluency. But Reuchlin's grammar was critical for the Reformation. And now all universities had chairs in Hebrew. So it is because of that we had Luther's Bible. Luther's Bible is important because of what he's done for the German language. It's a very beautiful translation, and that has to be kept in mind. And English, of course, the most important translation as a result of this Christian Hebraism was King James Version of 1611. These two stand out above all translations. Then suddenly now, in the 17th century, there are paraphrases of poetic texts to the Bible. Folks began to realize that they could get the Hebrew and then try to paraphrase them in beautiful fashion, 17th and 18th centuries. We also had the rise of biblical criticism, because once you start reading Hebrew, you realize that the Vulgate, which is supposed to be Hebraica Veritas, is not all that accurate. And once you question the Vulgate, you start to compare with different versions. You start to compare the versions, you don't know, you have to figure out which one was original. And once you do that, you realize that even the Hebrew text with its pointing was interpretive. If you question that, everything else can be questioned. Sources and so forth. So he writes a biblical criticism in the 17th century. So I want to start with John Milton, which is arguably not modern, but pre-modern, but I want to start with Milton for a reason. First of all, his impact of the King James Version on Milton. Milton was a phenomenal linguist. He studied various languages, including Hebrew. And his Hebrew, as it turned out, was really quite good. I was really impressed by Milton's command of Hebrew. And Milton was also familiar with contemporary biblical scholarship, and this showed in his poems. He clearly has a strong preference for the Old Testament. He engaged Job in several works, far more than I think Milton scholars have recognized, and I'm going to bring out some of these. So let's start with his earliest. Among his earliest was a poem on the morning of Christ's nativity, composed in 1629. Such music as 'tis said before was never made, but when of old the sons of morning sung, quoting Job 38:7, while the creator great his constellation set, the well-balanced world on hinges hung, and cast the dark foundations deep, echo of 638:4, and bid the weltering waves that oozy channel keep, to keep the waters in abeyance. So we'll keep that in mind. In Paradise Lost, we read of the celestial choirs, spelled here with a Q. Milton's English is really good, I just wish he learned how to spell properly. Celestial choirs, it speaks of birthday of heaven and earth with joy and shout. The hymning praise they sung, and when first evening was, and when first morn. Milton, in these poems, recalling Job 38:4, 7, and 11. 38:4 speaks of the foundations of the earth, and then when the morning stars sang together, so in the King James Version, and all the sons of God shouted for joy, and then the staying of the waters. Okay? I want to do a cultural history of the word sang. This is important because it was King James Version that first translated the verb in question in 38 as sang. Prior to this, the Vulgate's translation, Lord, was used. And prior to the King James Version, there was hardly any reception on Job 38:7. Nobody, there's one Jewish poem that used it, but nobody found Job 38:7 particularly appealing. But King James changed a word from Lord to sang. And that changed everything, as you see. So King James made the word Lord to sang, and Milton, very soon after, took this translation and turned it to sublime poetry. Okay. So we think Job 38:7 is beautiful largely because Milton made it so. Okay. So you have that Job 38 then captured in the Ode of Joy in Schiller, made famous in Beethoven's 9th, and then Henry Van Dyke's English translation. All thy works with joy surround thee, earth and heaven reflect thy ray, stars and angels sing around thee, centered of unbroken praise. Mortals join the mighty chorus which the morning stars began. So Milton inspired Schiller, who inspired Beethoven, we end up with this English translation. Thereafter, we get poetry. See, so now suddenly, now this is poetry. See, before 1611, this was not poetry. This was not seen as elegant. But the one word sang, as opposed to Lord, changed it. We get Dante Gabriel Rossetti's poem, The Blessed Damozel, where he speaks of the stars that sang in their spheres, her voice like the voice of the stars. Another poem, The Rhapsody of the Morning Stars. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's Thanksgiving, The Morning Stars that Sweetly Sang. Lyman Whitney Allen's Apostrophe to Light. To nature's spheric choirs, the morning stars and the sun of morn, for the sake of the world firstborn. So poem after poem turned that verse to sublime poetry. just because of the one word sang. But this becomes poetry. It was accepted for politics as well. Woodrow Wilson in 1919 in Paris praised the signers of Treaty of Paris in 1919 as creators. These people, these men, he says, are creators forging the hinges, echoing Milton, laying the foundations, unlocking the hidden springs from which ceaseless fountains are to flow. And that event was the daybreak of a new creation, the like of which has not been witnessed on this planet since the morning stars sang together. So the idiom, the morning stars sang together, became an idiom for earliest antiquity. It was Francis Bacon who first made that claim, and it followed since. Much less poetic was Lyndon Johnson, who now using this text to talk about control of nuclear weapons as a prophecy. What he was doing is a prophecy. The morning stars sang together. And that together is the word he hit at. So we must all work together in order to contain nuclear weapons. Much less poetic than Wilson. Back to Milton. In his poem Lycidas, he mentions, under the glimmering eyelids of the morn. And that's quite well quoted in poetry as well. Here he is referring to, he's pointing, first of all, the eyelids of morn. It's mentioned in Job 41:18. On Leviathan, the King James translates, by his sneezings a light doth shine. Leviathan's eyes are like the eyelids of the morning. What does that have to do with creation? Why was Milton making this creation? Well, in 3:9, on creation, though the reverse of it, the text says, King James, let the stars of twilight thereof be dark. Let it look for light, but have none. Neither let it see the dawning of the day. Milton recognized that the dawning of day in King James Version is the same as the eyelids of morn in Job 41. So Milton, knowing Hebrew, was able to make the connection with creation that you find in the King James Version. Paradise Lost, is Satan talking to his nearest mate with head uplift above the wave, eyes that sparkling blaze, his other parts besides, prone on the flood, and bulk as huge as whom the fable's name of monstrous size, referring to Leviathan. Right, so here, Leviathan with eyelids like the eyelids of morn, his nostrils go for smoke, and out of a seething pot or cauldron. So clearly, Milton was pulling all this together, right? Now, Leviathan, which God of all his works, this is a huge animal that swim, him happily slumbering on a Norway foam. Who do you think Milton thought Leviathan was? Stretch out huge in length, the arch fin lay. What creature is this? The whale. So this was the interpretation of Aquinas. It was before, but Aquinas popularized it. This creature now wallowing unwieldy, enormous in their gait, tempest, the ocean where Leviathan, hugest of living creatures on the deep, stretched like a promontory, sleeps or swims and seems a moving land. And at his, so it's so huge, like a moving island. Right? And his trunk spouts out of a sea. Clearly here, thinking of the whale, which had been a Christian interpretation since the 13th century with Aquinas. But here we have another take. Behemoth, biggest born on earth. Leviathan was the biggest of sea. Biggest born on earth, his vastness fleeced the flocks and bleating rows as plants, ambiguous between sea and land. The river horse, hippopotamus, is now behemoth, and the scaly crocodile is Leviathan. This is 3 years after Samuel Burchard wrote a definitive study in which he argued that for the first time, that behemoth was hippopotamus and Leviathan a crocodile. So Milton now, who you think that, who elsewhere thinks of the Leviathan as a whale, now says the river horse and a scaly crocodile. So Milton was fully aware of contemporary scholarship. Then we have his Samson Agonistes. It begins like that. He tells us the argument. Samson, made captive, blind, and now imprisoned at Gaza, there to labor as a common workhouse, on a festival day, a general cessation from labor, comes forth in the open air to a place nigh somewhat retired, there to sit a while and bemoan his condition. He is the latter-day Job, where he happens at length to be visited by certain friends and equals of his tribe, which make the chorus who seek to comfort him. So clearly here is an allusion to Job, but which Job? Reference to him, in a condition, but the name Samson Agonistes. In what ways was Samson Agonistes? An Agonistes is an athlete. So it goes back to a testament of Job. And Milton was not alone. There are other writers at that point who were writing poems in light of the earliest interpretation of Job. So, a little onward lend thy guiding hand to these dark steps, a little further on. For yonder bank hath choice of sun or shade. There I'm wont to sit, where any chance relieves me from my task of servile toil. This is an allusion to 7:1, where the King James Version, in departure from the Vulgate, is there not appointed time for man to man upon earth? Are not his days also like the days of a hireling? As a servant earnestly desireth the shadow, and as an earthling looketh for the reward of his work. Milton is alluding to this. But rush upon me, thronging and present, times past, what I once was and what I am now. Oh, dark, 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 amid the blaze of noon, irrecoverably dark, total eclipse, without all hope of day. Oh, first created beam, and thou great word, let there be light, and light was over all. Why am I thus bereaved, thy prime decree? Influenced by Job 3, let the day perish, let the day be darkness, neither let it shine, let darkness, blackness, all through Job 3, 1 to 10. So that is the context. Had I not seen thus exiled from light, as in the land of darkness, yet in light, myself, my sepulchre, a moving grave, his life of misery, he is as if living dead, the grave. Referring to Job 3. Infants which never saw light. Job wished he could be like infants never saw light. He would rather die and go to the yonder world of darkness, because there the prisoners rest. Wherefore light is given to that human being that's in misery, see, who longs for death, and they rejoice so much. See, they're so miserable, they dig for death, and they rejoice when they find their grave. Clearly, this is the background of Milton. Okay, so more of the same. So finally, he ends, this is he, softly a while, let us not break in upon him, or change beyond report, thought, or belief. See how he lies at random, carelessly diffused us, so forth. Can this be he, that heroic, that renowned? Agonistes, again, Job, the hero, the warrior, the athlete. Right? So he clearly combines the old readings from the Testament of Job, right, and his knowledge of Job, the King James. Right? So the friends come from afar off, they try to comfort Job, and there are numerous references to this throughout Milton's poems. Remember, Milton was blind, right? He became blind, completely blind in 1652. And soon after, he wrote this. When I consider how my light is spent, ere half my days in this dark world and wide, that one talent which is death to hide, lodged with me useless, though my soul more bent, to serve therewith my maker and present my true account, lest he returning chide, doth God exact day laborer light deny? clearly echo of Job. Job 7 and so forth. I fondly ask, but patience. That's the one of Job, not Hebrew. That's patience to prevent. That murmurs soon replies, God doth not need either man's work or his own gifts. Who best bear his mild yoke? They serve him best. Here he's reflecting on his own blindness and his struggle. He saw himself as very much like Job in darkness. A turning point, decisive turning point. One turning point of Job came in 1710. A few years before that, a French philosopher named Pierre Bayle wrote in 1697 an essay arguing that the persistence of evil in the world makes it impossible now for us to claim a good God. Leibniz, a polymath, mathematician, philosopher, and scientist, coined the word theodicy. He's the first to use the word theodicy, derived from two Greek words, theos, God, and dike, justice. He argues in this essay that well-reasoned vindication of that is possible to a well-reasoned vindication of divine justice in the face of evil. Right? That you can in fact reconcile the idea of a good God with evil. The existence of evil, he posits, does not mean that God is absent or unjust. In fact, the world is at its optimum, the best of possible worlds. It may not be perfect, but it's the best of possible worlds. Now, there's no mention of Job at all in Leibniz, but you can see how this immediately will have impact on scholars understanding Job. So commentaries and literature coming out of this right after 1710 became influenced by Job, most famously Alexander Pope. Alexander Pope, the great poet, himself suffered from illnesses, from TB, was greatly influenced by Leibniz. He's cited Leibniz many times. Among his works are two pieces that engage Job. We'll look at part of one piece, an essay on man. It begins like this. Expiate free, O all the sin of man, a mighty maze, but not without a plan. It's a mighty maze that we live in, but not without a plan. A wild where weeds and flowers promiscuous shoot, or garden tempting with forbidden fruit, together let us beat this ample field. Try what the open, what the covert yield. So he is really echoing this in light of Job 38 and 39, the divine speech on nature, right? Laugh where we must, be candid where we can, but vindicate the ways of God to man. Theodicy, right? So 38 is seen as theodicy. Presumptuous man, the reason wouldst thou what? The reason wouldst thou find? Why form so weak, so little, and so blind? Why form so no weaker, blinder, and no less? Well, God does exactly what God does, right? Form the weak, the little, and the blind. But if you can, the harder reason guess. Why form no weaker, blinder, and no less? So everything is according to plan, the best of the world. Furthermore, he argues, he says, we have a lot, so I'm trying to get. So, then say not man's imperfect, heaven in fault, say rather man's as perfect as he ought. Human beings are not perfect, the world is not perfect, but it's as perfect as it can be, an optimal world. And human beings, though imperfect, is as perfect as they can be, as God meant them to be. All nature is but art, unknown to thee, all chance, direction, which thou canst not see. All discord, harmony not understood, all partial evil, universal good. And spite of pride, in erring reason spite, one truth is clear, whatever is right. God sends not ill if rightly understood. You just have to understand correctly when there is trouble in the world. Partial ill is universal good. The astonished defense of divine justice, this was very common after 1710. But in 1755, the Lisbon earthquake hit on All Souls Day, November 1st, 1755. It was an earthquake, Richter scale about 8.5 to 9, and a tsunami. 50,000 people perished at least. 85% of the buildings in Lisbon were destroyed, including the two most important churches. This is a major turning point in the interpretation of Job. After this event, there is no longer any straight defense of God's justice. After this event, critical turning point in literature and so forth. See, after this, you can no longer go with Leibniz. See, that all the world is as bad as it could be. How could it be? See, when 5,000 people die, and don't tell me this is punishment because it's happening in a Christian city, where the largest church on All Souls' Day, when they all gather to worship on a Sunday, that's when the earthquake hit. Don't tell me this is God's will for the good of humankind. Hence Voltaire, see, a poem on Lisbon's disaster, 1 year later. He also wrote Candide, or The Optimist, the all-mocking Leibniz and Pope and others. So in Candide, which has a number of allusions to Job, I like the ending. So in the ending, Pangloss, who stood for Leibniz, right? Pangloss, all talk, all talk. So Pangloss is Leibniz. He's all talk and always going around proclaiming that everything is working out for good. So towards the very end of the book, he tells Candide, whose name simply means simple, but by no means still, he started very simplistic, and he grows to become more sophisticated towards the end. Right? As he goes through trials and experiences the world, Candide becomes more and more sophisticated. It's right at the end. So Pangloss now, despite all his suffering, there's concatenation of events in this best of all possible worlds. For if Candide had not been kicked out of the magnificent castle for love of Miss Cunegonde, if you had not been put into the Inquisition, if you had not walked over America, if you had not stabbed the Baron, if you had not all this, right, you would not be here eating preserved citrons and pistachio nuts. So all is for good. You see the slam on Leibniz. See, at least you can go to Oxford, all that, but you won't be here eating pistachio nuts. See, if the world was that bad, Candide just replied, all that is very well, but let us cultivate a garden. It's an echo of Jeremiah, you see, in exile. See, we cannot figure it all out, but let's cultivate the garden. Live as best we can. I've come to really appreciate Voltaire. I mean, I can't really appreciate Voltaire. I've always been taught, you know, he's this guy who destroys faith. I go back and reread him. He's profound, just moving, and just a beautiful poet. You know, he writes beautifully. So, and look at this. This is no atheist speaking, you see. He's a doubter, right? But here is the practical word. All that is very well. Well, maybe optimal or whatever. Let us cultivate the garden. Faust is well known for his Faust and the Tragödie. Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. I won't rehearse the story. In 1808, the final version came out. Because this is a prologue in heaven, which is very much like a prologue in Job. And there you have a wager between God and the adversary. And then the rest of the book is actually about a tragedy, where there's a wager between Faust and Mephistopheles. But it's an interesting background to this. So Faust did not just do this classic out of nothing. He depended on classics before him. The classic he first drew on was a work called Historia von Dr. Johann Fausten by Johannes Spies. Drawn about a real figure, an actual figure, Dr. Faust, an alchemist, who conjures up the devil and makes a deal. The devil agrees to be Faust's servant and provides him with whatever he wishes, but Faust must abjure Christianity. And the moral of the work is that you must stick to the rules of Christian life, or else you endanger yourself and you may end up with the devil. It alludes to the Bible quite a lot, but nothing from Job. Nothing from Job. And the English translation of this became the basis of Christopher Marlowe's Dr. Faustus in 1604. And again, Dr. Faustus, nothing alluding from Job. Marlowe's play became quite famous, the most famous dramatization of the Faust story. And the play went on tour in Germany and was very popular. Very popular in the time of Goethe. So this tale up to this point was entirely theodic. It entirely affirms that God is just and a reliable judge. And it has got a moral. You must act rightly or else you end up with the devil. Goethe had worked on the work for a long time. It was Goethe who first made the story of Faust a Joban drama. He was first to make the connection between Faust and Job. In 1773, he began studying. He read earlier Job dramas. In the 16th century, there were a number of dramas. For some reason, 16th century became a time when there were lots of dramas on Job, several in German. You have Job a comedy, Job a tragedy, Job a tragic comedy. See, and Goethe read them all. Okay. And he admired Hans Sachs' work on Job a tragedy and adapted it for his work. So he was already playing with the idea of Job as drama using Faust as figure. He began working on his Faust starting in 1774. But by 1790, he published a fragment called Faust ein Fragment that completed a fragment, completed a manuscript known as his Urfaust. It was lost, but later it was found. What's interesting about all this is that there's no prologue. There's no prologue in the earlier Faust by Goethe. So the Goethe prologue was added at the end. So the question is, what's the effect of adding of the prologue? Now we have two wagers. We have a wager between God and Mephistopheles, and it's in prologue, and a wager between Faust and Mephistopheles, right? In the second. So the second is clearly based on the classic that he used from the 16th century. And now he's also using Job, he's combined the two. What's the effect of that? The effect of that is that God and Faust now mirror one another. So that if you indict Faust, as they have done since Spee's work and Marlowe and all the moralists, you also indict God. In the earlier moralistic version, they indict Faust for this wager. See? And Goethe says, God did the wager as well. Look at the book of Job. So Faust is a mirror of God. Faust is the image of God, you see. By adding the prologue, Goethe turned theodicy into anti-theodicy. The old Faust without Job was meant to be theodic, defend the justice of God. And by adding this prologue, it changes everything. See, after Lisbon earthquake, you can no longer have a sweet theodicy. So Goethe did not just take the Faust story, he put a prologue, thereby indicting God, because if you think Faust is guilty, as we all have, see, since the 1600s, so too, see, God's a suspect character. And then at the end of the second part, notice, Mephistopheles said, what ails me, Job-like? Boil on boil my skin. Who is Job? You see, not Faust, the one who is Job is Mephistopheles. Brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. I did not know about this good prologue part until I began to read. And I just saw some inconsistencies and I did the research and I thought, gosh, that prologue was the brilliance of Goethe in working on Faust. That's what changed everything. I want you to, if you do not know this poet, I'm introducing you to a guy named Sholem Aleichem. The Sholem Aleichem is a pen name. Sholem Aleichem means something like, howdy, y'all. Okay, it's a pen name of a person named Sholem Rabinovitz from the Ukraine near Kyiv. His father was a rich merchant, but lost his wealth, so the family fell into poverty. Sholem's mother died during cholera epidemic when he was 13. At that time, Jews were not allowed to pursue higher education, and so Sholem ended up being a tutor for a daughter of a wealthy Jew. Her name was Hodel. So, does it remind anyone of Hodel? Fiddle on the Roof, yeah. So Patrick and Hodel's story. So they fell in love, and they were caught, and he was fired from his job, of course. They eloped and married against the father's wishes. Still, when the father died, he left his wealth to them, and they lived well in Kyiv. But he, after he had gained his fortune, lost it all in a stupid investment. Lost it all in stock speculation, he had to flee. That was 1890. Now, you all know the name of the play is Tevye the Dairyman, and well known in The Fiddler on the Roof. How many of you think The Fiddler on the Roof has any reminders of Book of Job? Nothing, right? You know, there's no connection with Philip Book on Job at all, you see. Making my point, you need not mention Job for it to be Jobin, okay? Well, we'll see this, right? So The Fiddler on the Roof has Tevye, whose name, by the way, is God is Good. A theodic name, like Tobias, like Tobit. God is good. He was poor, traditional, basically honest, faithful, and likes to quote the good book. Though what a good book is in question. It's everything is from the past. Talmud, they all belong to the same thing. See? He lost 3 daughters, according to the movie version. The losses being increasingly painful and difficult to accept. The most difficult loss was the loss of the last daughter, Hava, little Havala, the most tragic and unacceptable because she ends up with a Gentile. So what do all these have to do with Job? Well, the name Tevye is the same as the more familiar Tobiah. Going back to the theodic reading in the book of Tobit, God is good. Originally, there were 8 short stories in Yiddish. Tevye becomes a wealthy man. The Lord gives. And Tevye loses all his possession. The Lord takes away. It's chapters 1 and 2. All right, first 2 stories. But despite it all, Tevye blesses God. So it's very clear in the original Yiddish stories that it's connected with Job. Right? And there are autobiographical elements in it. See, the wealth to poverty story is what Sholem experienced twice. Once as son of his father and once on his own. Gained wealth, lost wealth. He tutored a rich man's daughter by the name of Hoddle, with the name of his wife. See? So they fell in love and married despite objection of the father. So the story is important. I mean, it's very important because it's the first modern literary work based on a Jew based on Job. It's the first modern work by a Jew based on Job because Job was not important at all in the life of synagogue. So the fact now you have this late 19th, 20th, early 20th century book that turns to Job for the first time, right? Where Job's a Jewish character, that's the first. This is the first reception that's among Jews that sees Job as a story of faithful protest. You remember up to this point I said that Jews basically thought Job deserved his suffering. Even if they were Jews, they deserved his suffering because they're chastisements of love. Here is the first time that a story is told, a story of a Jewish experience and faithful protest. The Bible had been intensely studied by Jews through the 16th century, what the Jews call the medieval period. From the 16th century to the late 18th, there was hardly any interest in the Bible. See? And after that, there were people who quoted the Bible, but the Bible was not at the center of Jewish studies. It was Talmud, another tradition. The Bible was not important to the Jews. Jews in general did not know the Bible in depth. They cited portions here and there, mostly memorized from Bar Mitzvah and the like, and had no idea whether what they said was Bible or Midrash or prayers. See? And so anyone who goes around quoting the Bible frequently was a sage, a wise man. You see, which is the point. Tevye is a sage. He is the Rev Tevye. See, he is a sage, a rabbinic scholar, regardless of accuracy of his creation. It doesn't matter. He could quote, and that makes him a Bible scholar. The story of Hava is the climax of the book. In the original story, we hear that she is always drawn to dominant culture, to the Russian culture, and can be a bit embarrassed about being in the ghetto, in the chattel, with her Jewish folks. She admired Russian literature, especially Gorky. And she tries to persuade Tevye, who is this Gorky guy? I know nothing about this Gorky guy. Well, who cares about him, you know? And she says, you are always quoting. She's so mad at him because he's always quoting the Bible. And this. She says, you have a quote for everything. And sometimes a quote for many things, she says. Of all the daughters, she's the one who wants to be Russian and dismisses his biblicism. And she defends her affection for the village scribe named Fyedka. This is how you are open to other people. Don't be so narrow-minded. Be open to others. Not be prejudiced against others. So they will not be prejudiced against us. We complain about them being prejudiced against us, but we, in fact, are prejudiced against them, she argues. See? But interestingly, her relationship with Fiatka is not viewed as gradual romance, as in the movie. Rather, it's the result of a direct, deliberate effort by Gentiles to convert her. In fact, they basically kidnapped her. Tavia heard first of her relationship with Fiatka through the village priest. He'd gone to see the village priest, and he finds out that, you know, he keeps saying, "Don't worry, we have custody of her now." He said, "What do you mean you have custody of her? I'm a father." He said, No. She's meant for bigger things." And he could not get through to them that he had right with his daughter. They won't let him see her. And Tavia later suggested that she was nearby, probably listening in the next room, while I was groveling on my knees, begging for your life. Harvard in the next room, laughing at him for Jewishness. See, Tavia learns of it through the village priest. He cannot see her. So he had to go to the priest, and basically grovel. And this priest, he said some Hebrew in seminary, and he thinks he knows the Bible better than I do, better than all the Jews do. And so he would talk to Tavia about the Midrash, Talmud, and so forth, except he keep talking about, "And you and your Midriush and your Talmud, oh, you Tevel." He mispronounces the name and calls him Tevel, which is like Teufel, devil. Talmud, he called Talmud. See, Sholem Alekhem doesn't play with language. See, so when he speaks, trying to speak Hebrew, it's totally goyish. "Your Talmud and your Midrash," he says. "Oh, you Tevel, Tevel." He keeps calling him Tevel. And all the Russians call him Tevel. Devil, basically. See, he cannot get Tavia. So, it's the environment. So, she marries Fiatka and goes with him. And she did come to say goodbye, and he didn't want to hear her and so forth. But she's very determined. Even though she was sort of kidnapped, she was a willing participant. So, Hava, whose name in Hebrew means Eve, is cast out from her family and from Jewish faith. But in the end, she comes back. She comes home and asks for forgiveness. And Tavia pondered, and since God is forgiving, he decides to forgive. The text does not say why she's come back. But 1819, there's a movie version done of this, written by Sholem Aleichem himself. And it was remade, so that 1819, I believe, was the first year silent movies were made. And that first year silent movies were made, you got this Yiddish movie based on Job. Okay. So 1939, there was a remake in Yiddish of the original Yiddish version, silent movie, based on Sholem Aleichem's script and produced in consultation with him. So as they were filming the movie, Nazi Germany had invaded Poland. Right, as they were about to film the movie. Here now, Hava wants, like the original, wants to assimilate to the culture of the Gentile majority. She did not want to speak the language of Hebrew and Aramaic that Tavia keeps pushing. Other daughters tried, but Hava wouldn't do it. Despite all her Jewish upraising, she turns away from her faith. But very quickly, as she marries Fiatka, she realizes that she made a mistake. She is treated poorly by her husband and his family, and he is a captive in that family. See, the story is told differently now because now Nazi Germany. Those Gentiles are not just trying to convert you. If you go with them, you make a mistake. But she escapes. So she's like a prisoner in their home. And finally, she manages to escape, and she comes back to her father. And what's interesting is that when she comes back, it's lost in translation. So it's Yiddish when a narrator speaks. It's Hebrew and Aramaic when only Tavia speaks. And then it's when the Russians try to speak it, it's butchered, goyish Hebrew. And then you have these daughters who are trying to speak Hebrew. See, and Hava wouldn't do it. But now at the end, she comes back. She said, "Father, I was not torn off. I didn't fall. My soul has remained yours as always." "No, I didn't. This was a mistake." It's not the original story. But in 1939, it made sense. You see, for Jews to go marrying Gentiles, like those who kill us, that's a terrible mistake, and no Jew ever do that. So she comes back. She begs her father, and says, "Wherever you go, I will go. Your life is my life, your fortune, my fortune." She says in Hebrew. Daphne was impressed. That's exactly what we say in the book of Esther, he says. Is it true? What am I saying? It's Ecclesiastes, he says. Yes, Ami Amecha. My people, your people. That's how Tavia's daughter should talk. See, so now she is back, reclaiming her Hebrew language. The words of Ruth, the Moabitess, is put in the mouth of this Jewish renegade who has reclaimed her faith and her people and turned away from the Gentiles who killed their people. Then we can fill on the roof. This is still set in Eastern Europe, but the story is now told in the context of America in the 1960s and 70s. The Broadway play in the 60s and then the movie in the 70s. Now Jews had largely assimilated into American culture. Now in this new Gentile world, there are no blatant attempts to convert Jews, generally not, and no attempt to tear them from their families, no virtual kidnappings, right? Hava simply fell in love with Fiatka. She was not kidnapped. And Fiatka is a sincere and decent Russian. As Tavia's family are preparing to leave Anatevka, Hava and Fiatka show up to bid them farewell. And Hava says that they too are leaving to go to Krakow. And Fiatka adds, sadly, we cannot live among people who do such things. So they leave. As a couple leaves, Tavia mutters, "May God go with you." The scene now reflects the realities of the American Jewry, where Jews married outside their faith often, and that, while not ideal, was finally worthy of a blessing, even if martyred. You see? So three different Havas. Fill the roof, though you see nothing in Job in it, it's based on Job. During Nazi Germany, there were at least two Nazi plays. The first is by an SS officer named Kurt Eggers. Eggers wrote a play called Das Spiel von Job dem Deutschen, the play on Job the German. So the main figure is Job the German. It's a mystery play in verse, terrible verse. It's lousy German. I'll tell you there's another one that's beautiful. And it's a story about light and darkness. And the story involves our test. The test is, will Job remain German? Will he retain his German spirit? So God and the devil make a bet. And if Job will remain keep his faithfulness to being a German, he will be given dominion of the world. So Eger studied theology at Göttingen. Where he was a great admirer of Ulrich von Hutten. Ulrich von Hutten was a German nationalist, a knight in the time of Luther. So when Luther did his Reformation, they were worried about the threats of Italians coming, right? And von Hutten said, I'll defend you. And he was pushing Luther to become more militaristic. I'll come back to this, okay? So von Hutten was, Eggers, for some reason, was a great fan of von Hutten. He even wrote a play about him. Then he went and became a pastor. For a very short time, he finally was kicked out because his views were so extreme. So thank God that people of conscience stood up. But in the play, the evil enemy says to Job Shiro, you speak well of victory because you suffer nothing. Human life is a warfare. Familiar? Where is that from? Right, that goes back to Crusader material. It goes back all the way to Jerome's translation, Life on Earth is Warfare, and it was used to refer to justify secular power and later on to attack Jews, yes? Okay. Surely human beings have a hard service on earth, and Jerome there translate hard service as militia. But it's not, if it's just that one line, I won't make the connection. But later on, the Archangel Michael, who was protector of the Germans, see, human suffering leads one to maturity. That's Gregory the Great. See, in order humans should grasp its meaning, a better has been granted to them. Whoever complains about it and despairs is not worthy to be a human being. This was based on Crusader preaching. That was based, ultimately to the book of Job. I suspect that Agers got this from Ulrich von Hutten, but I've not been able to access him. He wrote a lot, okay? And there's too much German to read. I haven't tracked down Ulrich von Hutten. Do you know, Peter, anything of that sort? Any for Ulrich von Hutten's work? I cannot know of Ulrich von Hutten quoting Job, but I'm going to track it down because it must go back to Ulrich von Hutten, I think. So it had a route back to Crusader preaching. Job the German finally praises, is faithful. He praises homeland. Wherever my eyes gaze are fields and forests and meadows. This is my land. Fathers have acquired it at great cost. Fathers have died for this land. The epilogue. God says in the epilogue, I saw the suffering of German. I saw the struggle of the German. I saw the victory of the German. It is enough. Where in my earthly Reich is someone equal to the German at enduring and winning? Consequences. Consequences. Oh, German, I bless you for your faith. German, I praise you for your strength. May your works endure forever, oh, German. May your land be the fount of the world which enlivens and sustains all mortal. Take off your servant garment. My hand will crown you and propitiate all boils and wounds which you receive in battle. The earth will be given to you so that you will lead it and rule according to my will. You, German, enter into your Reich. Consequence, not reception of Job. And Archibald MacLeish wrote a very famous play that won him the Pulitzer Prize in 1959. J.B., A Play in Verse. It's a play about making a play. A play about making a play on the book of Job. And it stars two have-been actors. Okay. One of them is Mr. Zeus, whose name sounds like the Greek god Zeus, Dios in Latin, Theos in Greek, God, a balloon seller in a circus. His opposite is Mr. Nichols, his British old Nick, the devil, the popcorn seller. And they wear masks at certain points in the play. Mr. Zeus' mask, quote, is huge, white, blank, beautiful, expressionless mask with eyes lidded like the eyes of Michelangelo's Night. Nichols' mask is dark, open-eyed. The eyes, though wrinkled with laughter, seem to stare, and the mouth is drawn down in disgust. It's very important. So, MacLeish's play is set in the context of a circus, a tented circus. He makes this point, but somehow scholars don't pick this up. He's very emphatic. It takes place in a circus. The circus, the modern circus, was introduced in England in the late 18th century, 1790s or so. And he came to the United States coinciding with the abundance of 10 meetings of the Second Great Awakening, 1790 to 1840. It's interesting because the circus was condemned by the Puritan Americans as immoral. In general, play acting was just condemned by the Puritans. But circus, with bawdry, revelry, and various immoral features, was condemned. And yet, they appropriated the tent for the revival meetings. This is their moral substitute. So instead of that tent, come to this tent. And one of the great revivalist preachers was an ex-circus performer. And there are a lot of parallels between the circus and the tent revivals. Circuses were biblically themed. Souvenir books were called, and programs were called Bibles. And if there's inclement weather, so a successful show cannot be launched, it was called Jonah's Luck. And circus shows typically had biblical side shows. Solomon and the Queen of Sheba, exotic. Samson and Delilah. See? And it displayed strange creatures from around the world. There was a nine-month-old baby who was very hairy. It was presented as Baby Esau. And then you have, of course, Behemoth, you see. Behold Behemoth, Hippopotamus. As a divine imperative, you go visit the circus. So a display of wonders and miracles. So the circus folks appropriated biblical themes. And the biblical folks appropriated the circus method. So by late 20s, in literature, circus was mocked, right? This circus, the circus was a metaphor for religious people putting up a farce. See, it is no coincidence that MacLeish insists that a play takes place in a circus. So at the beginning of the play, Nichols, the Satan figure, said, "I heard upon his dry dung heap that men cry out who cannot sleep. If God is God, he is not good. If God is good, he is not God. Take the even, take the odd. I wish I could sleep here if I could." So they're trying to figure out who will play the role of Job in this play they want to produce. Who will play the Job of role? Well, no one to play. And Nichols said, "There must be thousands. What's that got to do with it? Thousands, and not with camels either. Millions and millions of mankind. Burned, crushed, broken, mutilated, slaughtered, and for what? For thinking? For walking around the wrong skin, the wrong shaped noses, eyelids? Sleeping the wrong night, wrong city, London, Dresden, Hiroshima. There never could be so many, suffered so much for less." An awareness of World War II, right? So, we have time to go to the play, but at the end of the play, Job apparently surrendered. Okay, from the King James Version, "I repent," and so forth. So the pork seller and the balloon take off their masks, you see. The play is over. And Mr. Nichols turned to God and says, "What's the matter with you?" "Nothing." "You don't look pleased." "Should I?" "Well, you were right, weren't you?"
"Of course I was right."
"Anyway, you were magnificent." "Thank you." He looked at the mask in his hand. He puts it down as though it stung him. Silence, and Mr. Zeus pretends to be busy with a shoelace. "Why did you say that?" he asked Nichols. "Why did I say what? What did I say? Why did you say it like that?" "Like what?" Anyway, you were magnificent. "You know, anyway, regardless." "Regardless of what?" "Now, wait a minute. You were magnificent, I said so." "What's gotten to you, my friend?" says Nick. "What's eating you? Being magnificent and being right don't go together in this universe. It's being wrong, a desperate stubbornness, fighting the inextinguishable stars, excessive imagination. You were right, and I knew it, and you were admirable, notwithstanding," he snickers. "Anyway, regardless." Something in Mr. Zhu's expression stops him. That tone, that look he gave me. He misconceived the part entirely, misconceived the world, buggered it. Nichols, giving in like that, whimpering, giving in? You call that arrogant, smiling, supercilious humility giving in to God? MacLeish saw ambiguity in Job's eventual words. So did Job say, "I repent and sit upon dust," or did he say, "I repent"? And so, what was the tone? I've been asking around for actors to read me that line, how they will read that line. I cannot get anyone to read me just the line the way I think it must have sounded. But MacLeish brilliantly captures the ambiguity of the closing. Did Job really surrender? See, did he give in? See? Or did he take pity on God and just shut God up? So finally, in the last scene, JB, the one who played God, and his wife were together. "Curse God and die," you said to me. "Yes. You wanted justice, didn't you? There isn't any. That's the world. Why did you leave me alone? I loved you. I couldn't help you anymore. You wanted justice, and there was none, only love. He does not love, he is, but we do, and that's the wonder." And the play ends. See, dissatisfied with the ending of Job, MacLeish retells it. It's about love, but God doesn't seem to love. See, but we don't give up. See, we go on. and, as Voltaire puts it, cultivate the garden. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Leong, for once again offering us such a wonderful, rich odyssey, really. Extraordinary journey from Reuchlin in the 16th century to MacLeish in the middle of the 20th. I don't think I've ever heard a lecture that manages to get from one to the other in an hour.
I left out a lot, of course, but yeah.
So we have a few minutes now for questions. So who'd like to ask the first question? I have one from a couple of days ago from outside Dunedin,
yes.
But I'll come back to that
okay.
later on.
Yeah. Please. There's a lot more wonderful stuff, but I just, I could not pack them in. It's too much. But I'll be doing a book on Job and literature at some point. That will have like 40 pieces of literature from Job with my readings.
Elizabeth.
Just briefly, what happens in the 19th century? We go from the 18th to the 20th.
19th, there's a lot. There's Melville.
Yes.
Yes. No. There's a lot. Yes. There's a lot of others that I didn't get into. There's Tristram Shandy.
Yeah.
There's Hopkins. There's Oliver Goldsmith. There's a lot. There's a lot. And Melville. But Melville is just too big for me to cover.
Yeah.
There's a lot. I wish I could do Melville, but it's just too complicated for me trying to take it on.
Did Emerson ever tackle Joe?
No. Not that I'm aware of. No. Yeah. Not that I'm aware of. I've searched, but I haven't found any. Yeah. I would not be surprised, but I've not found any.
Anybody else? I do have a very fiddly question about
yes.
Shalom Aleichem. That passage where he quotes Ruth and then...
Yes.
Is it significant that Ruth, Esther, and Ecclesiastes are all in the Megillot, that they would have been in the synagogue?
Yeah.
So it's
right.
not just any old text.
Right. It's the Megillot,
missed,
right? That's true. Yeah. Festal scrolls. See, but whether it's a scroll for joy or sadness, it's all thrown together anyway.
Yeah.
Because it's for various festivals celebrating various events, joyful and sad. And Shalom Aleichem is all just for all of a piece. Shalom Aleichem knew the Bible very, very well. Exceedingly well. So I need to go back and reread it. It's written in Yiddish, and I tried to read what I could. I need to go back and reread it. It's just very clever, exceedingly clever. And so much of it is lost in translation. Also reading Kafka. Kafka is very similar to Shalom Aleichem. And again, the use of language. The German, simple language, complex German, and Americanisms, all that. Just very, it's brilliant, but you've got to read an original to get it.
Chris.
Thank you once again. Question concerns what you think, having done all this research, a commentary is. How has your understanding of what a biblical commentary is changed as a result of your work, especially in terms of your sense that interpretation demands an accounting of the history of consequences.
Yeah.
Could you reflect on that for a moment,
yeah.
please?
In some ways, my commentary is conservative in that I stick with the text. Basically, the Hebrew. I write commentary on Hebrew. Sometimes there are some scholars who argue now there's no longer a need commentary. We really need write works on history of reception. I don't agree with that because the church needs. We all still need commentaries, so we start somewhere. See, and my starting point is the Hebrew text. Right. So I try to do that. So while I admit that there's no original, I try very, very hard to get back as far as I could. At the same time, I look backward beyond the origin, but also forward. See, so I think a biblical scholar, cannot only do one thing. So you've got to try and do it all. See, so while I'm not a theologian, I do try to do theology with that, and I do that by engaging various interpreters. So yeah, I hope, and I think that I see some. I hope this changes the way scholars do commentaries. And nowadays, in fact, even the technical commentaries have begun to do reception. Even ICC, even the International Critical Commentary Series are now having some reception. Even Hermeneia and Anchor Bible, now people are doing some reception. But I want it to be deliberate. For me, it's not something you tag on. So the commentary series, they will talk about, so they will discuss the exegesis, and then at the end of it, they will add on music and so forth. I think that's not the right way to go. That's to say, those are add-on. For me, those are interwoven, and I try to engage them as I read the commentary. In other words, I read the commentary as a historical critical scholar and someone who's with tradition, but also constantly engaging various attempts to grapple with the text.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. So yesterday you talked to us about art and today about literature. And one of the interesting things about reception history and history of consequences is that they can put new lenses on it so that we see things differently.
Right.
So I was wondering that in your study of reception and consequences, have you ever seen poetic expressions or references to Job in literature that then have made you go back and look at Job and see
absolutely.
Things in Job that you didn't see before?
Absolutely. I was telling James yesterday that chapter 14, which I is on the hope in the tree and so forth, I had written the commentary already. I did a reception, and then I started to see all this music. I started to explore them and so forth, and I went back and rewrote the commentary in light of what I had learned from music. This piece, for instance, will have impact on how I read the end of the story. So yeah, sure. So I go back and change my mind all the time. So yes, many, many pieces, I look at, God, they got it. You know, and chapter 3, for example, chapter 3, Job cursed his birthday. But Didymus the Blind in the 3rd century already said, it's not just the birthday, he's Christian creation. And scholars only now recognize that and they think it's new. Didymus found that in the 3rd century BCE, 3rd century CE. See? So Nicholas was on the spot. So it's learning how to read the past with appreciation. So usually when I read this, it sounds bizarre. Like, God, this is crazy stuff. Where do you get this? Then you listen very carefully. What are they doing? They're reading the text very, very closely. And often, so I try to get in between and pull out the little jewels and say, see, there are jewels we learn from the past. See? As David Steinmetz used to say, the modern scholarship for all its contribution it's wrong that there's only one meaning in the text. Mm. The pre-modern interpreters, for all their weaknesses, are right. There's often more than one meaning in a text. So we learn about alternate meaning, and then we put forth whatever people can learn from it. At the same time, I'm also putting forth the nefarious ones as warnings to us. What could happen when we read the Bible without, when our interpretation will have consequences. So I try to do both. I try on the one hand to speak to the church and try to lift up people who read the Bible. But the other thing I want to do is simply I want people to enjoy the Bible. Mm. Just enjoy the Bible. See? Right? And if they hear the word of God, so much the better. But if they just enjoy and love it and to read it, I'm happy.
I've got a question from James in England. Again, this isn't me. This is
in what? In England?
From James in England, who's been getting up in the morning to
I'm so
watch
impressed.
The live stream. This is connected with the lecture back on Monday, I think. And it's an interestingly worded question. Could you ask Dr. Siow if he agrees with the assessment of some scholars that Job is equally as Jewish as Deuteronomy and Obadiah?
Yes. Well, it's Jewish work, depending on what you mean by Jewish, right? Yeah. It's a very Jewish work, but it's also protest. It is not mainstream, right? It's protest literature, but that is very much Jewish. Mm. And keep in mind, Job is one of those books that never, the place of Job in the canon was never questioned from the Jews. I like Ecclesiastes, Proverbs, Song of Songs, the canonicity of Job was never in question among the Jews. That says a lot. Jews saw this as a very Jewish work. It's not the same as Deuteronomy, and at the other, it's not at the center. It's at the periphery, but very much a Jewish voice. So they said yes.
One more question, and then I'll hand over to the head of department. So, Marvin, I'll hand over to you.
Yeah. Cool.
What does it say that the Jewish people, when they canonized the text, they took parts of the Bible that were contradictory to each other. For instance, the first two books of Genesis. What's it say about our reading of the Bible when we say that they shouldn't contradict each other, that they are factual, not poetic? Could the Bible have been come together if Jews had had that same attitude when they canonized the Bible?
Christians and Jews certainly have a different take on the Bible. I mean, for the Jews, it's a lively conversation of all points of view that you listen to. They don't homogenize it, right? I mean, I think there's a center, but the center is not the whole story. So it's conversation. The conversation is what matters. The Jewish Israeli scholar Moshe Weinfeld once asked me, he was really puzzled by that. He said, "I don't understand you Christians," he said. "You know, when you, two persons disagree, you form two different three denominations." You see? Whereas for Jews, there are four of us with five opinions and they're just fine. See, why is it you have to come up with only one truth, and when you disagree, you form three truths? See, I think we have a lot to learn from that. So I don't think the Bible is a monolithic book. Not to say it has no dominant message. It does. See, but a dominant message is constantly corrected by the voice on the periphery. They're equally important. So I think for me, the Bible is powerful because it encapsulates a spirited conversation about the experience of God. See, the experience of joy and faith and the experience of doubt. See, so for us, when we doubt, we are not the first. We have Ecclesiastes going before us. We have Job going before us. If we protest loudly against God, that's fine, the Bible tells us. We need not only have Psalms. And by the way, Psalms, not all praise either, right? 60 out of 150 Psalms are protests, and they're called praises.
Thank you. Well, I'd now like to hand over to the head of department for a...
Thank you, James, and thank you for introducing our speaker tonight. I'm Will Sweetman, as James said, the head of department, and it's my pleasant duty to thank our speaker for what I understand have been a very well-received series of lectures this week. Particularly, if this was any kind of example, then I'm sure they've been wonderful. What else was I going to say? I think that was it, actually. Thank you. Thank you all for coming and contributing your questions and to discussions. And please, we have a small token of our appreciation to you. I'm so glad that the weather stayed clement for us. We didn't have Jonah's luck this evening. The snow stayed away, and we had a good audience for you. So thank you so much for your coming.